from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Joshua Johnson, sitting in for Dave Iverson. What do Marilyn Monroe, Henry V, and the Norse god Odin have in common? They've all taken orders from Kenneth Branagh. Most recently, he played Sir Laurence Olivier giving orders to Ms. Monroe in My Week with Marilyn and directed Sir Anthony Hopkins as Odin in the action blockbuster Thor. You might best know him from his Shakespearean film roles, including his first lead acting directing job in Henry V. Tonight, the San Francisco International Film Festival will honor him for his outstanding career. But before that, he stops by to share his craft and take your questions. Kenneth Branagh for the full hour next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Joshua Johnson, sitting in for Dave Iverson. This hour, we're joined by Kenneth Branagh. He's in town accepting the Founders Directing Award tonight at the San Francisco International Film Festival. It's the latest honor in a long and storied career, one that ranges from paranormal reincarnations to Shakespearean classics to comic book blockbusters. He's played every kind of role, from that bad guy in the wheelchair in Wild Wild West to the valiant King Henry V. He even got to play Sir Laurence Olivier and has acted alongside one of Olivier's contemporaries many times. We're glad to have him for the hour and to take your calls. Kenneth Branagh, welcome.
Thanks very much, Doctor. It's very nice to be here. Thank you for asking me.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for saying yes. How is San Francisco? You enjoying your visit?
Very much so. I came here first over 20 years ago and was bowled over by the city and by all the places and sights that I'd seen growing up on television in the UK. And San Francisco is a very exotic and exciting place where actually, half the time you think that the city is populated by car chasers with very famous people in them at all times.
Exactly. So just like Beretta.
Exactly. So I was a little disappointed that I didn't see Clint Eastwood fly over a hill on my first visit. I haven't seen him this time, actually. But
We can make it happen.
I love the place. Good. Please give him a call.
Exactly. What have you been doing in San Francisco other than the film festival? Seeing movies, seeing the sights?
Yes. I went for a run yesterday down by the water and just to be in sight of Alcatraz or the bridge and to drink in the city a bit. Was fantastic. I went to a movie, very brilliant documentary from Sweden at the festival called Women with Cows, about two elderly sisters in Sweden. It turns out to be a sort of story of Shakespearean proportions. One is a terribly beaten up by a back injury that she has, and the two of them are isolated, bickering, sad, funny. It was great. It was a packed house. The festival was doing. It was a packed house at 1 o'clock yesterday afternoon. So, the place. My experience thus far in 36 hours is once again San Francisco is thriving as always.
We aim to please, and I know that this is probably the most humble hour for me because I know that there's no one listening to me. They are all here for you.
Oh, shush!
That's what they are asking me to do is just shush and let you talk. So I'm going to give the number right now. It's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Also email us forum at kqed.org. Some of you have posted wonderful questions to our Facebook page, including a few that are very funny. One or two I can read on the air. I'll try to get to as many as I can, but please keep the questions and comments coming. I want to begin with regards to the film festival. You're receiving the Founders Directing Award. There is a write-up in the film festival website in the program that is done by Jonathan Moscone, kind of describing what it is about you that makes you laudatory. Here's a piece of what he wrote. Quote, "There is nothing like a fierce Irish intellectual who knows how to use words. That's why I love the plays of George Bernard Shaw. Well, much to my surprise, Kenneth Branagh is also of Irish descent and has said that he owes his love of language to being Irish. He is also supposed to have said that he learned a British dialect to avoid bullying at a young age. That's a new kind of deterrent to bullying, pretending to be a Brit. And Kenneth Branagh has grown up to be one of the great and one of the most authentic pretenders of our time." End quote. Is that true? Did you learn a British accent to avoid being bullied?
It's not quite true, but it was at a time when my family left Belfast, where I was born, when I was 9 years old, and Jonathan's right to say that the sort of love of words and performance, I think, was definitely part of my Irish background. My father had five siblings. My mother had 10. So a huge extended family. And so in that early formative period, you know, the Jesuits say, give me the boy till seven, I'll show you the man. We were visiting. Our life was pre-internet, pre more than three channels of television. It was visiting. We visited the family. Our entertainment, our life was the family. And at family gatherings, which was sort of every day or every other day, it seemed, in some formal or informal way, people performed. Everybody had something they did. You know, my mother used to sing a song called Marguerite. My father, who had no musical talent, nevertheless would tell a story. He had a number that he did. People just did. So you sat there at people's knees and listened to great Irish performers do, as a matter of course, sort of oral tradition happening before your very eyes. So I think it's right to say that familiarity with words and performance was there in an unforced way. There was no showbiz background. Nobody was doing this professionally, but all my Irish family were doing it in the family, as it were. When we went to England, and from this, you know, very large extended family where it was impossible not to feel secure, you just knew who you were. It was as if in Belfast you couldn't get lost. You physically couldn't get lost, because if you didn't bump into one of your family or a cousin, you'd bump into somebody else from down the street. There was an absolute sense of security about who you were. And then we went to England, to a place called Reading, which was once where Oscar Wilde was incarcerated in jail. He once said, the only way to see Reading is going through it on a train. He obviously had a particular point of view about that. But we were there just with our little nuclear family, with my brother and I, my parents and my sister who was on the way. And when we first arrived, people literally couldn't understand us. Our accents were so broad; they couldn't hear us. So, being at school, and I remember the first question I was asked was I any good at football, soccer? And I said something like, "Hope so." And that was the beginning of what? What did you say? I hope so. And the trainer went, "I'm thinking." And so it became clear.
Was that a cough? Was that a sneeze? I apologize, but I didn't.
I think at the time, I think I was so a mixture of so shy and so, you know, and I had a very broad Belfast accent, which I think is a very beautiful accent. But at that time, also, the troubles were kicking off in Ireland. It was very, every night on the news, you were hearing something about how the town was exploding. And so it was difficult to make yourself understood.
If we had talked to the Kenneth Branagh back then with that thick accent and asked him what did he think of the troubles back then, how might he have answered in his brogue at the time?
In his brogue at the time, well, Joshua, I can tell you this. I think that when I was told that I was going to leave Belfast to go to England, I cried my eyes out. I cried every night. I don't know, for weeks it must have been. But do you know the thing that sold it? They said we'd have a garden. They said, you will have a garden. And I imagined this thing that was like the size of Dodger Stadium, because we were in a little two-up, two-down terrace house back home. And we got to England. And there was a garden, but it wasn't very big. It was enough to kick a football around in it. And, you know, it was a huge step up for my parents. And my father had a job over in England, and there was a different kind of security for the family. But it did feel that all of us were sort of wrenched out of something that just knew what it was. And we, for the whole family, from that point onwards, there was a period of kind of adjustment. And I think, you know, Jonathan might be onto something there, that basically there was a period, and maybe this is what happens with a lot of actors, a lot of performance, where you start to adapt, try to fit in, basically, in a way that, you know, maybe starts the process of giving you some of the skills, some of the complexes as well, you know, that are to do with the job you'll end up doing.
And with regard to those skills, at what point in your life did you realize that your voice, that your words had power, had impact?
Well, I liked...
To the point where you thought, oh, I can make a career out of this.
Well, I never thought that, because it was so, voluntarily anyway, because it was just so difficult. It was impossible to imagine. Us, our family... And showbiz was just, it was as if you would have to travel to another solar system to do that. It was never even an option. But I remember, this is the, you know, the world before American Idol or anything like it. There was not a vast culture out there saying, you can do it, dream big, you can do anything. The roots out were sport, and I... traumatically for me, I wasn't good enough at soccer, which I loved. Some kind of entertainment career, which we just didn't consider seriously. But I loved being involved in school plays, and that sort of evolved in parallel, actually, to an interest in sports. I was very lucky in the weird sort of atmosphere of the British school system. You know, it's helpful if you're both, if you're good at games and you're good at or you're good enough, you know, to sort of fit. So you can do the sissy stuff, like being in plays.
The sissy stuff?
Oh, yeah. This was, I mean, you know, certainly if you're going to, you know, as I played all sorts of things, Toad of Toad Hall in the school play, and, you know, dressed up in a very sort of lurid kind of green. And this was not, I think, seen as the right thing for a grown man or a grown adolescent to be doing. So it's just as well you're able to kick a ball around a bit.
For your safety.
Well, for your safety, before people decided that you needed to be taught a lesson. So I did start enjoy doing that. It wasn't until a teacher at school was the one to point out you could do this professionally that the notion of even thinking about it came into my mind.
Thank goodness she did. We're speaking with actor-director Kenneth Branagh. We'd love for you to speak to him also. Call us 866-733-6786. The lines are open. We'd love to talk to you. Also, email us forum@kqed.org. You have done quite a number of Shakespearean plays and films, acted and directed. Henry V was your first directing turn, a fantastic movie. I wanted to know more about your love of Shakespeare after we listen to this piece of Henry V. This is the brilliant monologue, the pre-battle speech that Henry V gives to his men on a day that turns out to be especially important for him and for them.
This day is called the Feast of Crispian. He that outlives this day and comes safe home will stand at tiptoe when this day is named, and rouse him at the name of Crispian. He that shall see this day and live old age will yearly, on the vigil, feast his neighbors and say, tomorrow is Saint Crispin's. Then will he strip his sleeve and show his scars and say, these wounds I had on Crispin's day. Old men forget, yet all shall be forgot, but he'll remember with advantages what feats he did that day. Then shall our names, familiar in their mouths as household words, Harry the King, Bedford and Exeter, Warwick and Talbot, Salisbury and Gloucester, be in their flowing cups freshly remembered. This story shall the good man teach his son, and Crispian shall ne'er go by from this day to the ending of the world, but we in it shall be remembered. We few, we happy few, we band of brothers, for he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother. Be he ne'er so vile, this day shall gentle his condition. And gentlemen in England now abed shall think themselves accursed they were not here, and hold down manhood's cheek, whilst any speaks that fought with us upon St. Crispin's Day!
It even works on the radio. Man, you're good. That's Henry V, acted and directed in by Kenneth Branagh.
So I'm going to interrupt you for 1 second, though. It's so sweet of you to say that. But you know why it works, of course, is because, you know, 400-odd years ago, this fella in Stratford-upon-Avon caught something so magically. He recognized the power of a moment in history and the ability of certain leaders. And he was talking about a hero to the Elizabethans, Henry V. And he found that way to meet the situation, a nation-threatening crisis, a group of underdogs, and the right words. And all the way through to this time, that sort of ability to ennoble people, to touch the human spirit, to make them feel bigger, better, larger than who they are, and partly because of who they are with, the company that they're with, is something that has stuck with. It's just gone into the poetic soul of those who hear it. And I remember being told that a man who quoted this in times of crisis, this particular speech, the one we've just been listening to, was JFK. But, and at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis, that's the reference to that sense of knowing what it was like when an individual and a nation meet a moment of crisis and might need, as well as everything else, they might need a bit of poetry. And that's what Shakespeare provided.
So talk to me as an actor and a director about how you capture that. Let's try to get back into your head as to where you were when you made that movie. I have the luxury of sitting back and just watching it and going, wow. But for you, having to think about how you not only perform Henry V, but also how you depict it and how the camera moves and how the extras are placed. How do you make all those pieces come together so we feel all those things you want us to feel?
Well, I was very lucky to, as an actor earlier, slightly earlier in my career, when I was 23, I joined the Royal Shakespeare Company and I got to play the role of Henry V in a very, very brilliant production by Adrian Noble, who was about to run the company. It was an experience of playing the role over 18 months. So I don't know, played 150 times or something, where you were able to understand how the play worked a little more. So you had the sense of when audiences had an intake of breath, when were the emotional highs and lows. And you also felt, I was playing this in a 1,800 seat theatre, the moments where perhaps the things that were beautiful about it could benefit from what I also loved, which was going to see movies where the intimacy and the sort of interior lives of characters could be revealed in a way that affected the audience in a different way, no better nor worse, but a different way from being in that huge communal live experience. And so the idea of two sort of dynamics for the play, one, the version that took it outside and you saw big things and thousands of people and a great sort of wide landscape that gave you a sense of the epic nature of the play, different from what was possible in the theatre. And then the idea of understanding a little differently, the interior life of a young man under pressure. Those things were very inspiring to me as I performed the play, and it became clear that if there was ever any chance, I didn't imagine there would be, of being able to make a film, that I felt as though I could see the pictures for the epic version of it, and I could feel the sort of interior language of it as well. And so that I developed a point of view, and also I just felt that it was a very necessary piece. It said many things about politics, about war, about the internal dynamics of leadership that were very pertinent. We were just after a war in the Falklands in 1982. I did the show a year or two later, and it didn't seem very far after that when we did the film. So its pertinence, the kind of creative possibilities of putting it into the medium, feeling that it needn't be declamatory, it needn't be all the things that sometimes scare people about Shakespeare. People talking funny and loud and shouting and not really resembling a human being. I didn't sense any of that when I got to grips with the play, and yet I could absolutely understand that that was a problem for other people, and that a film version of this, if I could be as fearless as Henry V was a bit, then maybe it could make a difference.
I want to get to the phones in just a minute. And Laurie and Sonoma, stand by. I'm coming to you next. But since you'd mentioned leadership, I wanted to ask you about the process of all this. What has being an actor / director taught you about leadership?
I think that it is continuing to teach me, and it's an evolving process that I find is mostly to do, in my case, with listening more and more and more, and you give all men thine ear, but few thy voice, as Shakespeare says. I used to give a lot of notes as a director. I used to be sort of overprotective. I used to want to be over-controlling. I wanted to be there way ahead of the game, be the one who was up earliest in the morning and doing all of that. I'm not saying that it isn't great to be prepared or kind of look after people, but directing that leadership role, if you like, for me has evolved into something a little purer. Other people bring the things that I am thrilled that they bring, and I help to point in a certain direction for them. I don't do it for them. I don't need to bring the things they bring. I can't. I can't do their job. I need not do their job. It's not my job to do their job. My job is to create conditions in which they can do their job as well as possible. And I think to give maximum value as enjoyably as possible. It will always be dramatic. There will always be passion. There will always be ups and downs. But if you can, as it were, direct the context in which that work happens, and that involves a great deal of listening, then I think, you know, strides could be made.
I think we should take a few calls now for actor, director, and life coach, Kenneth Branagh, 866-733-6786. As promised, Laurie in Sonoma, you are on with Kenneth Branagh. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Branagh. What a pleasure. Thank you.
Good morning, Laurie.
First, I'd like to say you have this amazing way of being so giant and doing Shakespearean King, and then also being so darling. So just, I love you. I love your work.
Thank you.
Fun to have you on today. My question is, back when I saw Dead Again, I was just so struck by how you flawlessly played this very convincing American, easygoing guy opposite Emma Thompson, and I just always was so struck by that, and just now that I have a chance to ask you how you did that and how you took on this American persona the way that you did.
Well, thank you. A lot of listening, actually, and a lot of in the preparation for that movie, I would try to maintain an American accent, which I was trying to, you know, place in a very particular kind of spot. And so at the weekends, I would go to the movies as an American and try not to be spotted. And actually going through that process gets you past the sort of embarrassment factor. At that stage, I'd done little work that people knew, so there wasn't sort of an issue of being recognized a bit. And so I'd listen and test it on people and try and get through the sort of embarrassment factor and try and make it not too generic and yet also as sort of connected to this thing that Scott Frank, the very brilliant screenwriter of that movie, had, which was a sort of very strong connection to the film noir tradition that the LA version of it. I know there's a very strong Bay Area noir tradition, but it was trying to listen to the experts and then just keep practicing for months ahead of time before daring to do it in front of a camera.
So you had to go out and practice go through the pains of practicing being an American.
There were a few times when I was like going to a movie theater and asking for some tickets or for some popcorn, people would give you a second look.
What did you want?
Where are you from? Venus?
You know, actually, Hugh Laurie was on NPR's Fresh Air earlier this week, and Terry Gross talked to him about this, and he said he had trouble saying R's.
Yes.
He had to just drop them all the way down in his voice to make them sound convincing. Were there certain aspects of certain... Because you've done Southern Confederate, you've done L.A. American, you've done British. Are there certain vocal idiosyncrasies that are tough?
Yes, there are. But actually, with my Belfast background, what it gives you is that hard R.
Just turn it on like it's nothing.
It's in the DNA. Some scholars would argue that, you know, the way Shakespeare was spoken in the Elizabethan age was much closer to a sort of amalgam of either a Northern Irish sound slash North American sound. It was it definitely had that harder edge, those harder R's, a tougher consonantal kind of thing. But I mean, I've failed spectacularly on numerous occasions. And when I was playing Henry V at Stratford in the nighttime sequence, he goes into disguise, and I decided that I would use this very strong North Country accent, a Geordie accent, as we would call it. I was very proud of my Geordie accent, and in the reviews it says, and it's great, and Mr. Branner in the nighttime scene is effortlessly a Welshman. I'd miss that accent by about 400 miles.
Well, you know, nobody's perfect. We're spending the hour with Kenneth Branagh. He's receiving an award tonight at the San Francisco International Film Festival. We count it as an honor to have him here, and we're honored to have you too. Please keep calling. Pat in Half Moon Bay, you will be next when we come back from the break. We're also going to hear Kenneth Branagh in a very different kind of voice, a man who never had trouble with his diction, Sir Laurence Olivier, in the fantastic movie My Week with Marilyn. Our number is 866-733-6786. If you're locked out on the phones, try us on Facebook or email us, forum@kqed.org. I'm Joshua Johnson, sitting in for Dave Iverson. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio. I'm Joshua Johnson, sitting in for Dave Iverson, joined today by actor-director Kenneth Branagh. He's in town to receive an award at the San Francisco International Film Festival tonight, and he will also be speaking tomorrow at a screening of his movie Dead Again at the Castro Theater. As promised, let's hear from Pat in Half Moon Bay. Pat, good morning.
Hey, morning, guys. Hey, Kenneth, great to have you on the show.
Thanks, Pat.
I'm a Cork man by birth.
Oh, yes.
Robert McNeil, when he did his Story of English back in the 80s, said that the Cork accent is the closest accent to Shakespeare.
How interesting.
So he said, two very quick things. First of all, the gift of gab that the Irish have. Interesting to see that they're able to make money from it now, finally. And the second thing is Beckett, Sam Beckett. Any chance you're going to do a Beckett play for us?
Thank you very much. The gift of the gab, that's a wonderful phrase, isn't it? My father actually, you know, kissed the Blarney Stone in his youth. And he said that might have been what passed on whatever I'm trying to get away with right now. Beckett's a kind of an interesting question because he's such a mystery to me. I mean, it's a sort of wonderful music that I have to confess I don't entirely understand. So I recently went to see Waiting for Godot and walked out mesmerized. But currently he's an author who I'd rather hear and watch than maybe do because it's wonderfully beyond me is what I feel presently. But I may go back and look again based on your question.
Well, one author you certainly not had any trouble with is William Shakespeare. We've gotten a lot of comments online and also on the phone commending you for your work with Shakespeare, including from Tamara in Daly City. Good morning, Tamara.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call, and it's such a privilege to speak to Kenneth Branagh. What I wanted to comment on is how much I admire Mr. Branagh's production of Hamlet, particularly in the way in which he fleshes out the relationship between Hamlet and Ophelia. Most productions of Hamlet that I've seen focus on Hamlet's relationship with his mother and the way in which that relationship weakens him and makes him impulsive but uncertain. But Kenneth Branagh's production focuses on the relationship between Hamlet and Ophelia, how much he admires and loves her and wants to protect her, and the way Kenneth Branagh says, to a nunnery, get thee to a nunnery, with the firmness and the resoluteness in it that's filled with a sense of protection rather than derision, I thought was one of the most unique and commendable qualities of that production. So I just wanted to share that with you.
Tamara, thanks for that. I see you nodding your head.
Thank you, Tamara. Well, nodding at the amazing sort of perception of reading of that kind of possible dynamic in Hamlet. Certainly, I'm very glad that Tamara received that from it. I know that we went to great pains to just try and meet what the play seemed to demand there, which is a way of understanding what it is like when you lose a parent, you know, or when you are isolated. And Hamlet does, and is unable to grieve, is unable to mourn, needs a friend, wishes it might be his mother. It is not his mother. There is another lonely and isolated person in that court, and it's Ophelia, and they have a very rich relationship, which is, when you do the full text, which we were able to do, you know, you can fill in. And if you do it on film and you can see what people as brilliantly talented as Kate Winslet are thinking, as well as hearing what they say, you get a chance to let it occur to the audience in a different way.
866-733-6786. We're speaking with actor-director Kenneth Branagh. Toby in San Francisco, good morning. Toby, come in, please.
Oh, hi.
Hi, good morning. What's on your mind?
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me on, Dave, and congratulations, Mr. Branagh, on your award.
Thank you very much.
It was really great to hear the St. Crispin Day speech, and I'm calling in from the San Francisco Shakespeare Festival. We're going to be doing Henry this summer for
really?
Free Shakespeare in the Park, and so our professional cast and so many of our students are going to be pondering and speaking that speech this summer.
Fantastic.
My question for you is, your Henry was so reluctantly drawn into war when you did the movie, and so much has changed and so much has stayed the same. Any thoughts about that 25 years later?
And before you answer, Kenneth, Toby, you said you're doing the San Francisco Shakespeare Festival. Plug it real quick. When is the festival?
Oh, sure. Thank you. We're starting June 30th in Pleasanton, and then we move to Cupertino, then Redwood City, then San Francisco. So weekends, if your audience, KQED listeners, want to hear the St. Crispin Day speech fully produced, they can come and join us for free.
Fantastic. Thank you, Toby. Everybody needs a little Shakespeare in the summer. Kenneth?
Well, yes, it's a pretty remarkable thing to experience in the atmosphere of the outdoors, and it sounds like an exciting prospect for the summer. The thing about the play and all of the plays is that they, from year to year and from generation to generation, their meaning changes because the richness is such that, for instance, with a play like Henry V, you could read it almost entirely and predominantly as a pro-war play, as a jingoistic, nationalistic play. And in 1944, when Laurence Olivier made his film version of it, it was partly funded by the government as a part of the war effort to encourage people to fly the flag, as it were. When we did it, we were able to focus on what the play also has, which is questioning on the part of Henry and of other characters in the play to suggest that the necessity to go to war and the cost of war is something to be very seriously and deeply pondered. And both things and many other things are available in that play. I'd be fascinated to know how it strikes, you know, this group of the San Francisco Shakespeare Festival this summer. I bet it's unique and therefore uniquely worth visiting.
You had mentioned Sir Laurence Olivier, who you played very recently in My Week with Marilyn. Just had the pleasure of watching that movie. A fantastic portrayal. Michelle Williams did a great job as Marilyn Monroe. Let's listen to a brief clip from this movie. This is you as Sir Laurence Olivier reacting to seeing himself on screen alongside Marilyn Monroe. And although he likes what he sees from her, he's not so crazy about what he sees in himself.
You know, I thought working with Marilyn would make me feel young again. But I look dead in the rushes. Dead behind these eyes. I wanted to renew myself through her. But all I see reflected in that magnificent face is my own inadequacy. You know, I admire Marilyn, I really do, despite her behavior. She's taken everything Hollywood can throw at her and she's triumphed. That takes some bloody guts. An actress has to be pretty tough to get even a tenth as far as she has. But be careful, boy. She doesn't need to be rescued.
That's Kenneth Branagh playing Sir Laurence Olivier in My Week with Marilyn. That's a pretty damning indictment of himself that Sir Laurence Olivier gives. Do you ever look at yourself on film and see inadequacy, see the parts that you say, oh, why didn't I do that?
I think most people are harsh self-critics when it comes to performance. It's and questioning and criticism is a way to get better. I think you have to try to stop it going beyond that into some sort of masochism. Olivier, at this point in his career, I think was feeling these things very, very powerfully. And maybe that's what happens when you have reached what appeared to be a kind of, zenith of achievement. He was, best director, best actor at the Academy Awards. He was a sort of national figure in England, but he felt, which he says very candidly in his own autobiography, these are some lines from that. When he says he hoped Marilyn would renew him, it's exactly what Laurence Olivier wrote in his own book. It was a crisis for him. It was a midlife crisis. It was an artistic crisis, but it was also mixed up in feelings that he was not proud of, that were to do with, you might call, sort of petty competition with this woman, 20 years younger than him, who was a movie star and not whatever else he was,
not a real actor.
Well, that's part of the story of the film is, well, what does that mean? Some people would use those kinds of divisions, and indeed he did. But actually he recognized that she had something in her sort of performance gift, in the magic of her charisma, that he wished to have in the way that she had. But in fact, his magic was different, and he needed to come to the point of view of sort of seeing that. And so for me, it was a very interesting project to do, because it brought all of those things together. But, drama is when that kind of moment is presented at its most extreme. It may not be what happens to all of us every day, but it's perhaps a heightened version of what might could happen. And in that version, it reveals all sorts of things that are entertaining.
One of the things that I think we love about you is that when you are in front of the audience is that you always get it right. Unlike people like me who got something wrong in this hour, and I must amend it now, for some reason, and you played it off so nicely and you didn't say a word, the Founding Directors Award, I had the date wrong.
Well, do you know, I'm going to let you off lightly here, Josh, because this is entirely my fault, because...
yes, it is. You should have said something earlier.
Exactly. But no, in fact, because the San Francisco Film Festival and Film Society have been so unbelievably generous, not only was the handing over of a wonderful prize last night, but there's also a kind of another extension of the same thing this very evening.
Yes.
At the Castro Theatre. So it seemed to me that... you weren't wrong at all in any way, shape, or form. Yes, that's how I'd put it.
In another time zone, it would have been perfect.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the time zone I was in, because I've got jet lag. So frankly, you were speaking my language.
So we're both wrong.
Except we're both wrong.
We can
and
be
both
wrong
right,
together.
But that's what life's like, isn't it?
Exactly. So the Founding Director's Award was last night. The presentation at the Castro Theater is tonight. Yeah. Sorry about that. 866-733-6786 or email us forum at kqed.org. Let's take another call. Gerard from Dublin, and I'm assuming, are you in Dublin, California, or Dublin, Ireland?
I am in Dublin, California.
Okay.
I'm a former Belfast man myself. Thanks for taking my call.
So wait, so you are from Ireland, and you live now in a California city called Dublin?
That is correct.
Got it. What's your question for Kenneth Branagh?
Hey, Kenneth, good to talk to you. What do you think of the theory of Shakespeare not writing these plays? And as a second little follow-up question, have you been to the new Belfast Titanic Museum?
Morning, Jared. The Shakespeare authorship question, I think, is completely and utterly fascinating. I'm not currently convinced that the plays were written by anybody other than the man from Stratford. Doesn't mean they weren't, but just I'm not convinced. But I do think that the discussion of it is completely and utterly fascinating. I've got very, very close friends who passionately believe the plays were written by the Earl of Oxford or other candidates. I respectfully disagree with them, but that's not to say that they're wrong. But the discussion of it all is very fascinating. I was in Belfast for a couple of months in the autumn. I was doing a play at the Lyric, the newly rebuilt Lyric Theatre there. Didn't get to the Titanic exhibition, but was aware of everything that was gearing up for the memorial stuff this year, and it was very, very impressive from the outside.
Let's take another call now. Charlie from Richmond. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, Charlie.
What's on your mind?
Sir Kenneth, I just wanted to tell you, well, obviously I'm a great admirer of your work. And a lot of comments have been made this morning regarding characters that you've played that are admirable, lovable characters. But to me, the mark of a great actor is a guy who can play the other side of the fence and be a fantastic villain. And I just wanted to mention your performance in Conspiracy, which to me, in the subtlety and the nuance and the understatement of your—I believe it was Heydrich.
That's correct. Yeah, yeah.
As the Nazi who hammered together the final solution, I think that your performance created far more terrifying and menacing a character than a lot of the great icons in the horror genre, like I don't know, Hannibal the Cannibal and people like that. Just a stunning, riveting performance. I can watch it repeatedly.
Well, thank you very much. And, you know, it's interesting you mention that. Of all the things I've played, working on that piece, which was a 90-minute TV film for HBO about the Wannsee conference that initiated the final solution. It was the moment at which they said, okay, let's set the ball rolling. We will get rid of 11 million Jewish people in Europe. They just discovered the technology, as it were. They were just building these places at a spot in Upper Silesia called Auschwitz. And the film was 90 minutes. The meeting was 90 minutes. And to play Heydrich and to, across a period of a couple of months as we were making it, to repeatedly delve into that atmosphere where the kind of inhumanity of what was going on, as if they might be marketing a new kind of fast food or something instead of genocide, was the single part that has got under my skin in the most unpleasant way. I think it was true of all the actors in it, and I'm not surprised it had the horrifying effect it had, because it certainly had on all of us, and it was a remarkable insight into what happens when you come up against that kind of soulless individual.
How's the experience of doing a TV series different from other roles? Paul in Oakland wanted to ask about the difference.
TV is quicker. You move quicker, and sometimes that's a challenge when you're trying to maintain quality, and sometimes it's a real help when you're trying to be adventurous and take some risks. I love it. I do a TV show for the BBC and for Masterpiece here called Wallander, about a Swedish detective, and I have a ball doing. And so I love going medium to medium because I think it keeps me fresh anyway.
Roxana from had written by email that she cannot wait for the new Wallander episodes to come out. So the sooner the better.
July on Masterpiece.
Very cool. Since you mentioned the villainess, I also remembered another villain that she played, which kind of gets us into another genre of movies. Dr. Arliss Loveless from Wild Wild West. Now, I know what you're thinking. I know. It wasn't a critical success. The reviews were not. Things were not. But I wonder what you take away from the experience of doing something like that. I mean, no one bats a thousand. It was a fun movie. I certainly enjoyed it. I saw it the day that it came out. It wasn't a packed house, but it was a good film.
Yeah. Well, thank you. You're very kind. I mean, sometimes best laid plans of mice and men do go awry. When it came along, Barry Sonnenfeld just directed Men in Black and many other films. Great cinematographer. Will Smith, terrific actor. Kevin Kline, terrific actor. Based on a very interesting TV series from the 60s, a lot of talented people involved, and we all did our best, and it didn't work out. It was interesting to see that happening on a big scale. I was almost aware of it as it was happening, but there's nothing you can do except try and do your best, and sometimes your best and the best of best intention people isn't good enough, and I suspect it was not in that case.
I also just want to make sure that I read clearly that, to be clear, just to clarify what I'd said earlier, Kenneth Branagh was presented with the Founders Directing Award last night. Tonight is an evening with Kenneth Branagh. It's 7:30 at the Castro Theater tonight. It will be an onstage interview and a screening of Dead Again, a public screening at the Castro Theater tonight at 7:30. What about Harry Potter? Hannah from San Francisco asks, did you choose Professor Lockhart or did he choose you?
I think actually the part was going to be played by Hugh Grant at one point, and for some reason that didn't work out. And I was very lucky to be waiting in the wings. And a citizen of your good town, Chris Columbus, who was directing the film, and a terrific fellow and smashing director, and was just a great colleague to work with, was kind enough to ask me to do it. And I had a ball. It was a real experience. Although it was a relatively kind of contained role, I was involved with making the picture for about 9 months, and it was a real pleasure to meet the stars of the film at that young age, and then to have seen them across the last 10 years or so, including Emma, who was in My Week of Marilyn, and Dan Radcliffe, who I helped nudge into the world of theatre because we worked a little bit on Equus before he then had a triumphant appearance in it. It was his first grown-up part, as it were. I'm so proud of the way they've handled themselves and the work they're doing. And Dan's now had this huge success in Woman in Black, and they're pretty remarkable kids.
Let's hear now from a first-time caller, Janet in Oakland. Good morning.
Hi, I'm just calling in basically so I can gush and especially commend your flawless and hysterical performance in Much Ado About Nothing, which my sisters and I watched repeatedly when we were younger, all falling in love with you rather than Robert Sean Leonard, and it was one of many performances that really moved all of us to study literature. So thank you for all of your hard work.
Thanks very much, Janet. I really appreciate that.
We also got an email from Kim from Milpitas about Much Ado About Nothing. She says it's one of her all-time favorites, and she asked, she would love to know what convinced you to cast Michael Keaton as Dogberry. That performance has kept me laughing and talking about it for a long time.
Oh, I'm very pleased to hear that. Michael was so brave to come along and sort of put himself in our hands. He has a sort of lunatic quality as a comic performer that was able to meet Dogberry's sort of verbal insanity in a way that was, I thought, very Shakespearean. There was a kind of genuine foolish, lunatic, mad quality that had such fun and such relish that he made me laugh on the day. He makes me laugh when I see it now, and it was a brave performance, and it relied on the verbal dexterity of a man who always gets his words wrong, being technically well done by the performer, and it was. And then the ability, that inspirational ability that people with great comic talent have to just sort of go sideways, like Robin Williams or someone like that. And Michael has that in terrific quantities.
We're winding down our conversation with Kenneth Branagh. Feel free to go ahead and call in or email 866-733-6786, forum at kqed.org. I got a question from Twitter a few days ago. Maslow Child writes that Kenneth Branagh's last Shakespearean directorial effort was Love's Labour's Lost in 2000. Why no Shakespeare since? By the way, my favorite Kenneth Branagh Shakespeare movies are Much Ado About Nothing for directing and his role as Iago in Othello for acting. Thank you.
Well, in fact, we did make another Shakespeare movie. I directed As You Like It for HBO in 2000. We shot it 2005. It came out in 2007 on HBO with Bryce Dallas Howard as a brilliant Rosalind and Kevin Kline, wonderful Jacques. And I hope that we will make more Shakespeare films. And I, over the next two or three years, I very much hope to be returning to Shakespeare more regularly. In fact, I know that I will do so because it feels in my bones like it's time to do so. And so there's more on the way if we can persuade people to help us finance them. And if people like you, thank you very much, are out there ready to go see him.
What about movies like Thor? That was a fun movie. I really did enjoy that. Visually, it's just so stunning. It's a lot of fun. You've got these two very different worlds.
Yes.
Three, really. The Land of the Frost Giants and then Asgard and then Earth that you have to tell the story between.
Yeah.
It occurs to me that you could have just said, no, I want to play Odin. And I want to be in the movie.
Well,
what about just being behind the camera with a movie that is so not only huge, but also very much bounded by the material with a hardcore nation of fanboys, some of whom are my friends, who would break your teeth if you got it wrong.
Well, yeah, I mean, you put it very well because you've outlined everything that was the challenge of that made me say, I'm just directing. That's enough. I've got to wrangle the world of Stan Lee. I've got to wrangle the remarkable fusion between a very, very clever a gathering of the Norse myths using everything that's best about those dense fables and then combining it with the fun of the Marvel Universe and what Stan Lee could do with the language. He loved writing for Thor, and we wanted to get that sense of fun without sort of sending up the genre, because we were taking quite seriously the internal family struggle. There's a story not a thousand miles away from Henry V of a young prince, in this case Thor, who has to learn how to be a responsible leader if he is ever to take over from his father Odin, played by Anthony Hopkins. You've got to train very hard if you're ever going to take over from Anthony Hopkins. And in fact, those factors, the chance of getting somebody like Anthony there and these brilliant young actors, Chris Hemsworth and Tom Hiddleston, and putting them all together in that mix was a terrific part of the attraction of something that I did, because it was so huge, spectacular, way out of my comfort zone, but also had so many things that were absolutely naturally part of what I was attracted to. And I thought, well, I wonder if I could make those things all join up, then maybe this could be a pretty good movie.
How does the experience, since we are in the heart of Silicon Valley, how does the experience of the changes in technology affect being a director? Martin Scorsese was just at CinemaCon in Las Vegas, I think it was this week, and he told, it's a convention of movie theater owners, and he told them, he claimed, that from now on, every movie he makes is going to be in 3D. He said they're all going to be 3D movies from now on. Since we're, you know, in the middle of technology, Netflix is headquartered about 30 miles away. How do you deal with the need for flashier graphics and 3D movies and something that pops and deleted scenes that live on iTunes? Does that affect the experience of just making a good story?
You, I think, need to, as a filmmaker, ultimately hold on to what you feel passionately about, the stories that you want to tell, and then allow yourself to be excited about all the possibilities of how the telling of them might be affected by new technology and the digital and technological revolution. These are exciting times to be a filmmaker, and I think as has always been the case, whether it was from, you know, black and white to color, from silent to sound, through all the profound changes that have affected the medium, you try and stay true to your sort of creative gut and use every means necessary to communicate with your audience and try and find the organic way that integrates that. That means that you're not just trying to be flashy or trying to be fashionable, but you are trying to be as direct in your communication with the audience as possible.
We have so many great questions and comments. I wish we could get some more. I'm going to get to Nell from San Francisco on the phone, and then hopefully we can get to a few more questions. Nell, quickly, please. Oh, my goodness. I'm so- goodness. I hit the drop button. I'm sorry.
Okay,
Nell. You can beat me up for that later. You can take that on me later. Jackie.
We love you, Nell.
We love you, Nell, and I'm sorry. I'm very, very sorry. I made a mistake on the air, and I cut off Nell. I'm making a mess in front of Kenneth Branagh.
Oh,
but I will make up for it with this question from Jackie in Santa Rosa. She asks, how do you feel about modernizing Shakespeare, putting it in other periods of time?
Well, I've done it a number of times, and I suppose, again, you're trying to find whatever your honest response is to what allows the play to just have some additional context or richness or fun, you know. And I think if it's real, if your intentions are real, if it isn't just a trick, then it's fine. It's got to release the play and not confuse it.
Let's talk to Zoe in Berkeley. Zoe, hello.
Hi. I'm about to graduate from college, but 4 years ago I went to Castilea School in Palo Alto, where every year we celebrated Shakespeare's birthday with cupcakes and a sonnet writing competition.
Wow.
And at lunch break, we had a pin the lips on Kenneth Branagh competition. So, you know, we'd be blindfolded, spun around, and then we would have to, we had these like thicker lips, and we would have to post them on like a cardboard cutout of you. And it was all good fun, and every year there were, you know, a couple of winners. And
you know, you could have called me and I would have just shown up, you know.
Okay, well, I will let them know that I've graduated now, but I will let them know that
I'm happy to do the live version.
Zoe, I can hear you blushing through the phone, but it's okay.
Yeah, I really am.
Zoe, thank you very much for calling. I wish we had more time. I want to end with an email from Ken who says, coming from the Midwest as I do with barely a high school education, I found the language of Shakespeare plays both archaic and nearly impossible to follow until I saw you perform Henry V on PBS. From your anger over the tennis ball insult to the St. Crispin's Day speech, I was enthralled, nearly in tears. You made it seem more like singing than speaking, and you brought Shakespeare to life for me. I dare say that no one else could have done that for me, and I will be eternally grateful, as we are eternally grateful to you, Kenneth Branagh. Thank you for this wonderful hour. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Joshua. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you for all those fantastic questions, and thank everyone for who joined in. I really, really appreciate it.
Forum is produced by Christina Russo with assistance from Amy Machado. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Technical direction by Mr. Danny Bringer. Dave Iverson and Michael Krasny will be back next week. I'm Joshua Johnson, in for Dave Iverson. Thank you for listening. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.